Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and there's heartbreaking news from the FBI today. Agents were contacted last month by a person close to confessed school shooter Nicholas Cruz with concerns about his gun ownership, his disturbing social media posts, and, according to the FBI press release, the potential of him conducting a school shooting. The FBI says that the information should have triggered a follow-up by the FBI Miami field office. Of course, it did not. Now, in some states, that person would have been able to petition a judge to take away Cruz's gun. We want to take a minute to look at the law. There is a federal requirement that people involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital be added to a list of those banned from buying guns. President Obama expanded that list to include people with mental illness who received Social Security disability checks. Last year, President Trump revoked that rule, but some say the original law didn't work well anyway. Judge Stephen Leifman is with the 11th Judicial Circuit Court of Florida. Judge Leifman, you say in your state, it was very hard to get someone involuntarily committed and on that list.
It basically almost means that you have to have a gun to your head or someone else's head. And anything short of that makes it very difficult to involuntarily hospitalize someone here.
So you changed the requirement for someone's name on a background check in Florida. What happened there?
We did. What we found is that under the federal rule, you only get on the list if you're technically adjudicated, meaning you've actually had a court hearing and a judge has found that you meet that criteria. Well, the vast majority of people who come into crisis stabilization units with serious mental illnesses switch to voluntary status. So only about 1% of the cases were actually getting adjudicated. So the vast majority of people who may have come into the system who were imminently dangerous to self or others never got on the list, which would have prohibited them from purchasing a firearm.
But the change that you made was that, what, people who voluntarily came in are also going on the background checklist?
Yes. Basically, that's the change we made, is that if you came in meeting the original criteria that you were imminently dangerous to yourself or others, even if you moved to a voluntary status, you would, in fact, go on the list.
Okay, so that strengthened that. But as you know, Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel wants to strengthen it even more. He wants to give police even more power to take someone in involuntarily. Let's listen.
What I'm asking our lawmakers to do is go back to places like Tallahassee, places like Washington, D.C., and give police the power. If they see something on social media, if they see graphic pictures of rifles and blood, we need to have the power to take that person and bring them before mental health professionals.
So again, this would expand the ability of people who have concerns to involuntarily bring someone in. And that brings us closer to the so-called red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders started in Connecticut. This is where a police officer or even maybe a family member or a concerned citizen can petition a court to temporarily take guns from people if those people are exhibiting signs that they're posing a danger. They can, you know, just petition the court to do that. These laws have also been passed in California, Washington, Oregon, and Florida is one of 18 states considering that. This has reduced suicides in Connecticut. Your thoughts about, you know, people being able to call in and just say, I have concerns.
You know, usually when someone is exhibiting serious mental health issues, it's not a one-time event. And I think if you are able to look at the totality of certain situations and if there is enough evidence to suggest that the person may in fact be a risk to themselves or someone else, then we should intervene on a mental health status. These are not arrests, they are mental health. And I think by doing that, you're going to get better outcomes.
So, Judge, what do you think, though, of the people, and we always, you know, have to mention this, people who represent the mental health community, who say that statistically, even though more mentally ill people are behind these terrible incidents, there's far fewer violence within the mental health community as a whole, and this unfairly targets them?
It is absolutely true that people with mental illnesses are no more dangerous than people without mental illnesses, and that They are much more likely to be victims of violent crimes than perpetrators. But the issue shouldn't just be about mental illness. There are a lot of other issues. It's a perfect storm of possible mental illness and easy access to weapons. And I think part of the issue shouldn't be targeting people with mental illnesses per se. I think what we need to do is improve our mental health system. Florida's 50 to 51st per capita in mental health funding. So even if we do change our laws, if we don't improve access to care and allow people to get the care they need, all the laws in the world aren't going to matter.
You say that if we treated the physically ill the way we treated the mentally ill, what?
There would be a plethora of civil lawsuits and probably indictments for gross negligence. I mean, what other illness is it okay to discharge people sometimes in the middle of the night into homelessness, psychotic, when we don't give them what they need? And then they often get picked up on these quality of life offenses because they're still sick and we have not given them the treatment they need. I think instead of just looking at the dangerousness side of these laws, we should be looking at the need for treatment and then making sure we give them the access to that treatment.
Well, especially if we have a background check system that is dependent upon hospitalization records, if people feel that they aren't going to get a bed when they go in or aren't going to have insurance cover it, they're not going to go. And that's where we're getting the names that are going into the background check system. It seems like a flawed loop.
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, it's a flawed system all around, and it really needs to be overhauled from top to bottom.
Judge Stephen Lifeman of Florida, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the shooting in Florida was not only tragic and significant in its numbers, it also stands out because of the way the event unfolded on social media. Students were tweeting and even posting videos as the shooting was happening. For a look at that and other social media news, let's go to Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
And, you know, technology is changing so quickly and these school shootings seem to happen far too often. But was there something different about this one in the way that students were sending out texts and videos during the shooting?
Well, this is how teens live their life. They are digital. They are always online. So, of course, they have their phones with them. They have their tech devices with them. And as the tragedy was unfolding, we could see what they were seeing. We could fear their fear. The obits are really impressive. You're learning about the students one by one. People are taking time to actually honour them. Here's one that caught my eye. Havi posts underneath a picture of his cousin. He didn't make it. I love you, cuz. I'm sorry for all of this. I'm at a loss of words. And every time you see one of the fallen students, one of the slain students, you will see that those posts are shared by thousands of people.
There was a lot of admiration for student reporter David Hogg, who interviewed his classmates in a closet as the shooting went on. Let's listen.
I did have plans for my 18th birthday to go to Nexus Gun Range and learn how to shoot. But at this point, I don't even want to be behind a gun. I don't want to be the person behind a bullet because I don't want to be the person to point a bullet at someone. And to have the bullet pointed at me, my school, my classmates, my teachers, my mentors, it's definitely eye-opening to the fact that we need more gun control in our country.
Talk about David Hogg and also the fact that even in the moment, students were talking about gun control.
So let me set the scene for you. That interview was happening while the active shooter was at his high school. They were hiding in a closet and he's interviewing. This is a real journalist. He may be young, but he's a real journalist. Elise Shaver of VTAL says, "When you're old enough, David Hogg, run for office." She says that because David then got out. He was a survivor and then did countless media interviews. There's one that sticks in my mind. He was talking to a reporter. He turned to the camera, directly to the camera, and told the camera what America needs to do now, then turned back and continued to do his interview. Joe Concha TV, works for The Hill, says David Hogg is a high school journalist with a professionalism and lucidity that is beyond impressive based on his on-scene reports from Parkland.
So some incredible stories and sharing of information from students in the school. Femi, Russian bots, it turns out, are also a part of the story on social media. What happened?
Well, the reason we know this is because there are a number of websites now that track Russian bots, propaganda bots, propaganda accounts. Hamilton 68 is one website. It's run by the security organization Securing Democracy. And they noticed from Thursday these hashtags: gun control, gun reform now, Florida school shooting, Nicholas Cruz, who of course was the shooter. All of those hashtags created by Russian bots. Also, BotCheckMe tracks 1,500 propaganda bots, and they saw more hashtags like gun control Parkland, gun reform now. And the reason this is important is because the hashtags get out there, and then regular people, you and I, online, will start sharing them, and a conversation is started that doesn't happen organically. It is planted there. It is deliberate to start those discussions and sometimes tensions as well.
How did people respond just in the few seconds we have left?
People are having the conversation. There are very fierce gun control conversations happening right now. But just to bring it back to the teens, to the kids, This is something that Oscar posted. He says, as a 16-year-old in a Florida high school, I grieve for all the lives lost. It's time that my generation steps up and takes the reins and hopefully change our future. He gets lots of compliments from people saying, you're amazing. And Oscar says, hey, just a teenage boy trying to express how I feel. Sometimes these social platforms, social media at the very best.
Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
It's rare to see characters with disabilities on television, and rarer still to see actors with disabilities playing them, which is what makes This Close, a new show written by and starring deaf people, so notable. The show released on Sundance Now this week. That's the streaming service that airs shows from Sundance TV, owned by AMC Networks. Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, has some thoughts. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Right off the bat, I can't wait to see this. On your recommendation. But how does it look and feel? And, you know, the deaf community, some people sign, some speak, some have interpreters. What happens?
Sure. So this is basically the story of two young deaf people who are close friends and how they kind of navigate life. So Michael, who's played by Josh Feldman, he signs, but he doesn't speak. And his best friend, Kate, who's played by Shoshana Stern, she signs and she does speak a bit. And the two of them co-wrote this series as well as starring in it.
Let's take a listen. In this scene, these two main characters are at an airport.
Afternoon. How can I help you?
I'm with deaf, though. We would like to pre-board.
That's not a problem.
Thank you.
Can I see your boarding passes?
Sure. Here you go.
Mocking people who
yell. And
at
the end of that scene, she signs to Michael saying, he says, I don't know, why do you do that? You know, knowing that she's goading her. And she says, I don't know why. I just love doing it. So
tell us more. I mean, obviously they are deaf. Is deafness the primary thing they deal with on every show? I mean, how does it play out?
Well, I think that's a major element of the show, is sort of trying to present deaf characters who are not defined by their deafness, but, you know, of course, it's a major element of their lives at times. In the same way that for people of color, if you're an African-American, sometimes your race is a major issue in your life, and sometimes it isn't. So we see these two characters move through the world, but there are times when the world reacts to their deafness in a way that kind of smacks them in the head a little bit. And so we have a clip where Kate was invited to take part on an industry panel. She works as a publicist in Hollywood. And when she gets on the panel, she realizes it's all about handicapped actors. And so she has to tell them, you know, well, I'm not an actor, number one. And number two, I'm not sure that I appreciate how you group me in here. And so what we're going to hear is the person who's hosting the panel and the person who's translating for Kate.
I guess I'm here because I am the deaf girl in the office.
I wouldn't put yourself in a box like that.
I actually never thought of myself like that until now. You came to learn from our stories. That's great. But then what? You move on from this and we fade back into the shadows. To be honest, it doesn't even feel like it is our stories that we're telling. It's more like the stories you want us to tell. You focus on our disability, but not who we are.
And if there's a mission statement for the show, I would say part of it is that.
Yeah.
They're trying to get past these roles, these characterizations, where the character's deafness sort of defines who they are. It's very interesting. It's very compelling.
Well, you know, I'm thinking how long it's taken from Marlee Matlin, who had to, for the longest time, be like the deaf actress,
right.
You know, and one of the only ones.
Right.
But is it, look, the TV industry has been trying to be, you know, more diverse. Is that why this show is happening, or is it a, you know, good show?
Well, I mean, it is a good show. It's you can tell they made it on a shoestring. There are moments when the lack of money that they had for the project kind of shows through. But I do think that with this explosion of television, there is a hunger for TV shows that depict very specific circumstances that a wide range of people can relate to. So we're seeing people who previously were not allowed to be creators, not allowed to necessarily tell their own stories. They're finding ways and being provided opportunities where they can tell their own stories. And so, for example, both, you know, Kate and Michael had or have romantic relationships with people who can hear. And so there's a whole dynamic there where the dynamic between the couple's different, and then Kate and Michael share a bond that they can never share with their romantic partners who are hearing, just because of the very specific experience of being deaf. And the show brings you into that experience. So you are sitting in silence and watching the two of them sign with each other and reading subtitles and sort of getting just a tiny inkling of what it's like. There's one scene where Kate is in a meeting and her hearing aid malfunctions, and you start to hear, you know, they change the audio and make it sound weird, and then you get a sense of how disorienting that can be. So that's what's great about this show, is it pulls you into that experience.
You get to hear what she hears.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what do you think this means, Eric Deggans? We've seen a slow increase in deaf visibility. We mentioned Marlee Matlin.
Who plays a character on the show.
Oh, so she's in this too. But as we said, for the longest time, she was, you know, a standalone, somebody who actually had the disability that she as an actress was portraying. Do you think we'll be seeing more people who actually have the disabilities play the characters with the disabilities?
Well, that's definitely an ongoing conversation. I mean, one of the most popular new shows on television the past TV season is The Good Doctor on ABC, and the lead character is a doctor who has autism, and he's played by an actor who doesn't have the condition. There's been a debate because, again, the premium with these shows is authenticity, and that's hard to do if you don't have people who have the condition on the staff helping write or helping produce or helping perform, or ideally, all three.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to the struggling retail industry and what some are calling the retail apocalypse. As more people shop online, department stores and chains are announcing closures across the country, and small businesses are wondering if they're next. But are small stores in a crisis, or are they just transitioning to something new? Ali Schweitzer from member station WAMU spoke to business owners and retail experts about the state of shopping in the Washington, D.C. area.
The D.C. boutique Catch Can has been in business for almost 30 years, and it's become a gathering place for shoppers who like to stop in and chat with owner Suzanne McLean. But not long ago, McLean realized something. Customers had started to treat her store like a showroom.
The customer will come in and we'll help them for 30 minutes fitting a pair of shoes. And then they'll just take out their cell phone camera and take a picture. And then they will go home and they'll order the shoes online.
McLean says she's had to mix up her merchandise to gird herself against growing online competition. But she says there's a bigger shift taking place that has implications for small retailers across the country. McLean had a conversation with her accountant that brought that into focus.
He just said, oh, you'll be okay. He said, what you are now is entertainment.
In other words, stores today can't just be places to buy stuff, not when anything can be bought online, often at a lower price. Now, stores have to be experiences unto themselves, And that is changing the retail landscape.
The hits keep on coming for Sears Holding Corporation, who is now being forced to close another 63 stores across the country.
Macy's, JCPenney, GameStop, all announcing store closures in recent weeks. Sears says it isn't even sure it'll be around by next year.
The retailers are scrambling right now.
News reports about department stores and chains closing are a common occurrence, and there are a surprising number of empty storefronts here in D.C., even in busy commercial neighborhoods. All this could be a hangover from the recession.
At some point, I attribute it to 2008, the music stopped.
D.C. sales tax show retail growth slowed after the subprime mortgage crisis, and as Dorian says, many stores haven't done enough to win shoppers back.
Retailers weren't as engaged as they used to be in delivering stores that were interesting with merchandise that you couldn't find anywhere else.
Throw in the growing convenience of buying online, and a perfect storm was created. But Asadorian says the downsizing happening in retail now is actually a right-sizing. He thinks the D.C. area became over-retailed and full of predictable shopping he calls generica. Now, if people are going to go to the trouble of traveling to a store, they want things they can't find in an Amazon search. Anika Hobbs sells merchandise like that.
These prints actually come from Ghana.
Hobbs' boutique in D.C.'s Anacostia neighborhood is called Nubian Human. The shop sells handmade footwear, T-shirts that say Black Girl Power, and stylish clothing in Ankara patterns. It's the polar opposite of generica.
I really wanted a space that had unique goods in it, that really focused on people of color and had something different that I hadn't seen before.
Research shows that's what local shoppers want, too. Montgomery County in Maryland recently published a study of its retail landscape. The report said there are too many stores selling general merchandise and apparel, two categories that have been hit hard by e-commerce. And it suggests that struggling shopping centers could get a boost from more experience-based retail.
The retail that does extremely well is a retail that's really embedded into people's everyday life and a huge part of their community.
Jody McLean is CEO of the shopping center developer Edens.
We find that places that offer classes or access to learn how to make a craft cocktail, we find that people love those opportunities to come together.
John Asadorian says those kinds of in-person interactions that can't be replicated online are the future of brick-and-mortar retail. The industry just needs to pay attention to what people want and adjust.
It's sort of like a forest fire, you know? The forest gets blackened, but then the pine cones drop and the little seeds pop up, and the forest rejuvenates with these little seeds.
And he says that's why this is actually an exciting time for retail, because what those seeds grow into in the next 5 to 10 years is anyone's guess. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
U.S. housing starts rose in January, up to the highest level since October of 2016. The number of homes under construction is now the highest it's been in more than a decade, a good sign that the housing market is strong. At the same time, mortgage rates are also up and they could rise even higher. Joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. He's with us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is helping to keep this momentum in the housing market?
Well, in many ways, it just reflects this continued strength in the economy. We have very low unemployment. Interest rates are getting higher, but still relatively low. And one big thing that a lot of people are looking at when it comes to housing is millennials. Such a big generation that had the misfortune of sort of coming of age in the middle of the financial crisis. So the thinking is that postponed home purchases by millennials for a little bit, because if you're just graduating from college into a recession, as terrible as that one was, it's sort of delays how long it takes for you to be able to have the financial ability to buy a home. And one of the really interesting aspects of today's report is that that multifamily home starts, so in other words, condominiums and apartments, jumped by 24%. So I suspect that has something to do with millennials getting back into the market too.
But if they're getting into the market now, they're looking at interest rates that are higher than they have been. They're still historically low, but higher than they have been. They're creeping up. The 30-year fixed mortgage rate rose to an average of 4.38% this week. Is it likely that mortgage rates will continue to go up?
I would imagine it's a very real possibility. The interest rate that basically affects mortgages and every interest rate out there is the yield on treasury bonds. And with the government enacting these massive tax cuts and a federal budget that is going to also exacerbate the deficit, that means the government's going to have to sell more treasuries, and that tends to cause treasury rates to rise, which then trickles down into all interest rates. So I suspect that it's possible that mortgage rates will continue to go higher.
And that could have a negative effect on the housing market?
You know, it certainly would be a headwind to the housing market. I think what everyone on Wall Street right now is trying to wrap their head around is whether the stimulative effects of the tax cuts will be greater than sort of the headwinds that will come from higher interest rates.
One more thing, Mike. Today, the Department of Commerce recommended tariffs on steel and aluminum. What's the effect of that?
Well, you know, obviously the thinking is that this will help domestic producers, and we certainly saw that in the stock market, at least in the initial moments after the news came out. Share prices of companies like U.S. Steel and Alcoa jumped pretty good. But it does certainly bring up the risk of a potential trade risk, trade war. And this is something that the Group of 20 economies, you know, our big trade partners like China, Japan, India, Germany, and Canada have really warned America not to do this because it could very well start a trade war.
Meanwhile, we're watching the stock market, Mike, and it looks like this week will be a lot better than last week.
Better than last week, for sure. We're still rebounding from those massive losses, though this news of the indictments from Robert Mueller of the hackers certainly right. took a lot of the gains off the market today.
13 Russians indicted there for U.S. election meddling. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Four-tenths of a second from first place, 8/100ths of a second from third. That's the amount of time that kept Olympic skier Michaela Schifrin off the medal podium last night, to everyone's shock. The night before, she took the gold in the giant slalom, but last night failed to even medal in the slalom, an event she won in Sochi 4 years ago when she was just 18. Then there are U.S. men's figure skaters, Adam Rippon, a crowd favorite, but in seventh place. Nathan Chen in 17th. Elise Hugh is in Pyeongchang. And Elise, start with Michaela Schifrin. Clear favorite, so much expectation. What happened?
What happened? Well, she said that she actually got sick before the first run and that it wasn't the norovirus that's going around at the Olympics, which is causing vomiting, but instead just nerves. She finished that first run in fourth place and just didn't manage to stay on the podium, ended up in fourth place. She said she was quite disappointed.
Yeah, but you know, she said something great. She said, maybe the saving grace is that I'm not lying when I tell you this. It's not about winning races. It's about how I feel on my skis. And I was disappointed in how I felt on my skis. I mean, that's what she's concentrating on.
She also said, you know, I know this is going to sound arrogant, but I know I'm the best slalom skier in the world. Yeah. And so she admitted that what she did in the race today wasn't close to her best, and it's the race that counts. And so, yeah, it was disappointing.
Well, there was another upset last night. Norway's dominated the Super G event for more than a decade, but Matthias Mayer of Austria came out the winner there. But let's talk about the figure skating. Adam Rippon, Nathan Chen, they still have their long programs to go. But in 7th and 17th, Adam Rippon seems delighted because he knows he doesn't have quads. And, you know, he seems to be just enjoying, you know, beautifully skating. But what's the thinking about Nathan Chen?
Yeah, he was favored to capture gold. But this is his rookie Olympics. He came off an undefeated season. And the performance here at the Olympics today just really shocked fans because he faltered on every jump. And then his biggest threat, Japan's Yuzuru Hanyu, just sailed through a performance. It was a sparkling performance. And that means that Hanyu is really likely and favored to win the gold as we head into the longer program. Mm. So Nathan Chen's still the first skater ever to land 5 quadruple jumps in one program. His fans are sure this is not the last of him. It was just, you know, a performance that was full of stumbles.
Yeah. The yips. Well, boy, there was an incredible, I mean, you can't call it a stumble. Marcus Scherer broke his neck in a fall during the men's cross race in snowboarding. The video is, you know, pretty upsetting. He's coming off a hill, flying through the air, loses his balance, comes down hard on his back and his neck. How is he?
No neurological impairments, so that's good news for him. His goggles split apart and went flying in the air several feet from his body. We saw him lay on the ground for a while, but he was able to stand up on his own and then wave to fans as he completed the race. But yeah, that's a scary, scary injury. As far as we understand right now, no neurological impairments.
No. We will link you to reporting we did before the Olympics about how some people feel they've become too dangerous and that it's, you know, these are man-made dangers put into the games. So I'm sure there's conversation about that. But Elise, we spoke to you before the games as well about North Korea's participation. You've been reporting on a story involving the State Department, the U.S. State Department. Tell us a little about that.
South Korea ended up footing the bill for North Korea's athletes and performers and that cheering squad that's making so much news. To stay here in South Korea during the games. So South Korea is paying for the lodging and paying for the transportation and meals while they're here. The government approved funding somewhere around $2.7 million. So there were some questions and some controversy here in South Korea that this big lump sum that ended up being in-kind donations to North Korea, really for housing and free food and everything, would end up running afoul of sanctions that are placed on North Korea for its missile and nuclear mm-hmm. programs. But a State Department spokesman over East Asian Affairs said that South Korea is all clear for its funding of the North Korean visitors.
A little detente there. NPR's Elise Hu in Pyeongchang. Elise, thank you.
You bet.
Well, Olympic speed skating events continue on Sunday. It's a sport where falls are common, and they can impact even the people who stay in the race. Nat Mills is a 3-time Olympic speed skater. He now coaches kids in the D.C. area. Coach Nat, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
So I was watching speed skating the other day on the Olympics, the men's 1500, and you know, I don't know that much about the sport, but one of the things I noticed and was surprised by is that there was a skater, Cohen Verwey, who started off well, and then his opponent crashed, and the announcers immediately made clear that there was no way that he was going to get a good time because he didn't have his opponent next to him.
Right. In long track, even though it's one skater racing against the clock and your time is all that matters, when you're visualizing your race, you're trying to picture the skater that you're going to be racing with. When that skater is ahead of you, you're always chasing them. You're trying to beat them to the crossover on the backstretch. So to lose your pair never helps.
Makes that much of a difference in the time?
It can. It's a test of your preparation and your focus more than anything. But in a race like the 1500, it can make a big difference.
I wondered if there was some way for them to put like a little bunny rabbit or something that's on the side of the track that's electronic that will show you where you're supposed to be, but that doesn't happen.
No, that it's the technology games. That'd be nice. In fact, and if you're watching the TV feed, the that blue line
right.
that they show, which is the time, if you could actually be seeing that while you're skating, I don't know if that would help or hurt, to be honest. Like anything, probably some skaters it would help and some it would be a distraction.
There's also the issue of the draft. Tell us about that and how that plays into the speed.
Right. Unlike short track where you're in a pack and you can tuck behind the leaders like a peloton and have them break the wind for you. In long track, there's usually not an opportunity to have someone break the wind except for that brief moment when you're crossing from outer to inner or inner to outer and your pair might be ahead of you. And speed skating is all about overcoming wind resistance. The ice resistance isn't the factor, it's the wind resistance. So any little moment when you can have that eliminated or lessened makes a big difference in your time. Psychologically, it makes a difference because you feel like you got an advantage that you weren't expecting. And sometimes, depending on how good of an opening skater you are, that means how fast you open, you can try to time your strategy so that you actually do get a draft if you know what the estimated opening time of your opponent's going to be.
Now, the other thing I noticed is that the skaters swing their arm up all the way to their forehead. Is that typical that everybody has to touch their forehead with the arm?
Technique's an individual thing. Everyone has their own technique with their arm swing. But interesting you mention that, because I've been watching this games and I've noticed that almost all of the Dutch skaters, whether they're sprinters or middle distance skaters or even the long distance skaters, have an exaggerated right arm swing. They really throw it out in front of them. You know, and I'm wondering if that isn't a conscious technical effort that the coaches are telling them to try to just help their momentum or keep them motivated in their stride. But it definitely stands out. Other than that, though, it's pretty idiosyncratic.
How did you get into speed skating?
I just happened to be in the hotbed of the Chicago area when I was younger, and my folks had met someone who was an inline. And they were looking for something for their six kids to do where they could take them all to one practice, and speed skating fit that bill. They brought us all to the rink in Northbrook, Illinois. We all got on skates together. The practice lasted an hour, and we stuck with it. And that's how a lot of kids get involved. Some of them come from hockey or figure skating. And then, of course, today, a lot of the skaters come from inline speed skating. In fact, a majority of the U.S. team are all former inline speed skaters who made the transition. Some of them, it took a matter of years, and some, as in the case of one, Erin Jackson on the long track team that races next week, she's only been on ice since the beginning of this winter, which is amazing.
Is there an ideal speed skating body type?
There is not. And if you've been watching speed skating, you can probably tell it runs the gamut. You know, there's 6'4 giants that do well, and then there's 5'6 guys that race the same distance that do equally well. Short track athletes tend to be slightly smaller build and lighter, but that's not always the case either.
What's it like as a former Olympian to watch others compete?
I think I like watching the competitions more than I did like racing them. Of course, I know a lot of the U.S. skaters, some of them very well, so it's a little nerve-wracking watching them compete and really having no ability to affect the outcome. But I'm as mesmerized as any fan that tunes in and watch Olympics. It's just such a beautiful sport with the high def they have now, so many different cameras capturing so many different angles. It really, really is incredible to watch as a fan.
That's Nat Mills, who's a former Olympic speed skater and current coach. Nat, thank you.
You're welcome.
And it's been heartbreaking and enraging to hear from the FBI today that the agency failed to investigate a tip last month that a Nicholas Cruz could be planning a school shooting. Of course, he's confessed to carrying a shooting out this week. You're going to be hearing more about that missed tip on All Things Considered. Again, heartbreaking. But meanwhile, there were two attacks prevented this week, and that's worth noting. In Washington State, there was that grandmother who called 911.
What I'm reporting is I'm finding journal entries from my grandson. And he's planning to have a mass shooting at one of the high schools.
That attack was stopped. And another one might have been in New York. A former high school teacher and his twin brother were arrested in the Bronx yesterday, charged with an alleged bomb-making plot. Rochelle Boone is with New York One. And Rochelle, this former teacher at Democracy Prep Harlem High is Christian Toro, his brother Tyler Toro. Now, they've pled not guilty. But you report the school where Christian Toro taught came under observation back in December because a student called in a bomb threat?
Well, this is how the investigation all got rolling. A student called in a bomb threat, and then shortly after that, Christian Toro quit his job at the school. So after he quit his job, his brother, Tyler Toro, tried to return a laptop that was issued to Christian Toro by the school. When he returned that laptop, on that laptop is when they saw that online manual about making explosives, and that triggered the investigation.
Yeah. And by the way, it was a school computer, so a technician was just going through it as a normal procedure to see what was on it and found this disturbing manual that
through it.
Yeah, had been downloaded on, you know, how to build a bomb. So now officials are finding their way to the Toro brothers. By the way, we don't know that there's any connection between the student who called in the bomb threat in December and Christian Toro quitting soon after, and then this bomb manual being found. We don't know that that student was connected to this.
Yeah, the NYPD isn't giving much information about the student. The student is underage and will be in juvenile court. But we are told that once this investigation got going, they realized that there were a number of students who visited Christian Toro's apartment. And in addition to visiting the apartment, there were two students who were paid around $50 an hour to break down fireworks and store gunpowder in the apartment. So once this got going, police really realized it wasn't just, oh, a student called in a bomb threat and a teacher quit. It was something more than that.
And by the way, when you say students visiting, Christian Toro was also charged with rape of a minor that he was bringing home to his apartment.
Yeah, he was arrested on January 31st for that. But also, when they went through the apartment, they found letters in a backpack. Tyler Toro wrote in his diary saying something to the effect of, if you're a registered sex offender, things will be difficult, but I'm here 100% living, buying weapons, whatever we need. So many were speculating that he was writing in his diary about what was happening with his brother at the moment.
Well, look, these are all puzzle pieces. We don't have the full picture. But yeah, you could say he's saying, don't mess this up, brother, by having a sex offender offense, because we're buying weapons to do what we need to do. And as police went through their apartment, they found a box with about 20 pounds of iron oxide, 5 pounds of aluminum powder, 5 pounds of potassium nitrate. These are all materials that can be used to build explosives, 2 pounds of confectioner sugar, which can be used to fuel an explosive, a bag of metal balls that could be used as shrapnel. Pretty chilling.
It is very chilling, and it's still not clear what they were planning, but clearly they had a lot of explosive material. And on a note that was found in Christian Toro's backpack, it said, under the full moon, the small ones will know terror. So a lot of people are trying to read into that. What could this mean? Could this have meant that they were planning some type of attack, maybe on a school? Who knows? But as the investigation goes forward, I'm sure we will learn more.
Well, and are the parents of these kids saying anything about, you know, what their kids are saying about emptying fireworks to take out gunpowder in a teacher's apartment?
How those children ended up in that apartment is very puzzling to me. As a parent myself, I would be very upset, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the school has been very protective of the children there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we move forward and as the NYPD issues more information, we'll start to get a clearer picture of what happened there.
Well, meantime, Christian Toro says the manual was on his laptop. He didn't mean to download it, but he was researching the Boston Marathon bombing. And they both, as we said, pled not guilty. But it seems like a cautionary tale about, you know, a lot of people have questions. Well, how do you stop this? And in this case, it was from a technician seeing something on a laptop, and it raised a flag.
Mayor de Blasio, Bill de Blasio, was very clear about that yesterday at his press conference. He said, you know, sometimes people laugh when officials say, you know, if you see something, say something. And it's become very cliche. But in this instance, someone saw something and said something. And as the mayor said, may have saved many, many lives.
Rochelle Boone with New York One. Rochelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.